This is Ann Nicholson-Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago. This week we're going to talk about a wonderful production at Timeline Theater of The History Boys by Alan Bennett. And I'm going to divide the show into two segments. For the first 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk about a kind of offbeat issue, but one that can be so important in making or breaking a show, and that is the dialect. And here to talk with me about that are Eva Brenneman, who's the dialect coach for this show, and Will Allen, who plays Scripps. And then we're going to be joined by Donald Brearley, who plays Hector, and Nick Bowling, the director of the show, to talk about ensemble. Eva, I wonder how one gets into the business of dialect coaching, first of all.
Well, I think most dialect coaches start as actors, and I did. I was an actor. I occasionally still act, but it's not my primary focus. I studied drama in undergraduate school at NYU, and so I was always good at accents, and I was always liked doing them. They always freed me as an actor, which I think is something that for some actors, it's very freeing to have a totally different accent. And then for some actors, it's absolutely terrifying. And they can't imagine how they're going to act and do an accent at the same time. For me, I was definitely one of the people for whom it was freeing as
an
actor.
And why is it freeing, just out of curiosity?
Well, it's automatically, it's a way into the character. Mm-hmm. It's a different, completely different energy from your own. So therefore, it creates a certain costume or mask that you can mm-hmm. walk into and ideally fill out with reality. Mm-hmm. But it is an immediate way in the way that perhaps a costume piece can be, or a walk, right? But for me, that was something. I always had an ear, and my mother is very good at languages, so she genetically gave that to me. And I moved around a lot as a kid, so I had to learn to fit in. Mm-hmm. So that helped my ear, and then as an actor it helped. So there came a point in my career as an actor where it wasn't satisfying me, and I sort of moved away from theater for a while. When I came back, I stumbled into coaching at Mary Archie was my first gig. Mm-hmm. And then I kept getting referred, which was lovely, and now I'm at a point where I am actually a member of Timeline. I'm an artistic associate, and I'm also a production affiliate at Looking Glass. So I have these two theaters that are kind of my anchors, but I do get to work. I've got a reputation such that people call me now, which is great.
So how do you go about, first of all, learning and then teaching a particular dialect? In this case, we're talking about Northern England, I think,
right,
and a certain class.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, in this play, the primary accent and the accent of the place, we set it in Sheffield, where there is some textual basis for that choice, which is part of the work of the dialect coach, is to figure out from the text what would make most sense. Mm-hmm. So Sheffield is in Yorkshire, and so we decided all the boys would be Yorkshire, and then the teachers in that period would not necessarily have retained their natural accent, no matter where they were from in England. In the 80s, the teachers in their age group would have had to learn to speak the way that they speak in the show, which is a standard British, or RP as it's called. Mm-hmm. So that was the other accent that had to be factored in. The way I learn any accent is I find suitable samples. I use the computer, the internet. I have a lot of samples already, but there are many resources. But my primary go-to places, other than the obvious dialect sites, are NPR, BBC, radio documentaries. I'm a big radio fan. That's really those are the places I go to first. Mm-hmm. And then if I run into trouble, then I have to be a little more creative.
And do you analyze it? Do you try to say, okay, that's a really bright vowel, that's a schwa, or do you just do it by listening until you can imitate it and then not have to generalize or abstract it?
It's a combination. It's a combination of, doing the repetition of whatever I'm hearing. I repeat it for myself, and I feel sensorially and viscerally what am I doing with my mouth in order to accomplish this particular sound. And simultaneously, I'm noting for myself, okay, this is a different vowel than I usually do, and I know IPA, the International Phonetics Alphabet, from my grad school experience. So I use the IPA, although I don't necessarily use IPA when I teach, because many actors either didn't learn IPA, or they learned it, lost it, Mm-hmm. Learned it, were terrified of it, therefore lost it. And so I tend to use phonetics for myself and then what I call fake phonetics for the actors. I use mm-hmm. both for the actors. So I provide them with a breakdown of this is a sound that you would do, this is a sound that you want to do. Mm-hmm. And in that breakdown, there's usually phonetics and then fake phonetics next to it to
so
help them understand.
So fake phonetics is A as in bake or something.
Exactly, uh-huh. exactly. Mm-hmm. Something that is a little more accessible so that, because we're trying to put a show on, ultimately, right. you know, it's not my job to teach phonetics. So I use it, the ones that love it, and so they can pick it up. But mm-hmm. so I do, I break down the primary sound changes because ultimately you can't be conscious all the time of every single vowel that you say.
Right.
Because then you can't act. So you focus on the major ones, and I'm sure Will has his favorites of those from this particular accent, that were the problematic ones or the ones that he likes the best. And then you focus on those, and that tends to shape the mouth for you. I always call it dialect magic, that you grab those sound changes, you make those really strong, and what happens is that tends to form the rest of the vowels in a specific way. Hmm. And then consonants are often easier to grasp, but may be things that are hard to remember to do in the midst of doing the dialect for a show. But once I've assimilated it to the certain to degree, then I come in and teach it. And I prefer, if I can, if I've had enough time to prepare, to teach the accent in the accent we're doing, so that the entire dialect session is done in the accent that I'm trying to teach them, in the hopes that that will also help them grasp it, because the more they hear it, obviously, the better.
So like conducting a French class all in French.
In French, exactly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I can't do that. I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes it's an accent that is so beyond my range of experience, or, you know, I just worked on The Overwhelming up at Next, and I didn't conduct the entire session in a Rwandan accent because that felt a little odd. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have enough, you know, had not fully assimilated into my bones, so mm-hmm. I didn't want to lead them astray. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely do lines for them in the accent, but I didn't do the whole session in the accent.
In this one, though, you did?
Absolutely, yeah.
So yes. Then let's bring Will in
yes.
here. First of all, are you one of those actors for whom it's terrifying or freeing to use a dialect?
Well, I can say early in the process it was terrifying. I was one of the few boys when Eva came in on the first day and asked who has experience with this British dialect or this one, I actually couldn't raise my hand to any of them mm-hmm. Because I'd never had any formal dialect training of any sort. I'd pick stuff up from movies, and occasionally if we do a show at school, they'll bring in someone. But for the most part, I was terrified. And she actually, on the first rehearsal, I remember, she looked at me and she was like, I can see some of you are terrified. For example,
Will.
You, Will. And I was like, no, I just have abnormally large eyes. But I was terrified. Uh-huh. So to me, at first, it was terrifying. And for mm-hmm. the first, 3 weeks of rehearsal, all I was thinking about was, I'm saying this wrong, I'm saying this wrong, I'm saying this wrong. But then you get to the point where you start getting used to it, you start getting it down, and then it does, like Eva said, it does sort of free you and separate mm-hmm. me when I walk in to start getting ready to do a show and me when they open the door for the audience. Mm-hmm. So it's very rewarding and it's very interesting, and I think all the guys have tackled it in a different way, mm-hmm. but we definitely, as a group of eight, have spent most of our time when we're just hanging out together at a bar afterwards or going out to dinner, we're talking in these dialects. Mm. And we still do it now, even though the show's open. It's a strange habit.
So I assume you learn the lines in the dialect, or not? Did you memorize first and then...
I memorized my lines because, you know, this was my first big Chicago show. I had 8 months to get memorized, so I figured I should.
Uh-huh.
And so I learned the lines just in my own voice because I knew we would be doing something different. And so then I had to relearn them right. in this wacky accent that I had never heard before. I'd obviously heard standard British and heard people do that in shows, but this was one where, you know, there are different vowels that sound Irish, there are different vowels that sound Scottish, there are different vowels that sound like you're from London, or, you know, I was just thinking in my head, she's crazy.
This can't be right.
Nobody talks from so many places. And then the thing that really, really helped me was, you know, I was having all this trouble. And she's like, think about it. There's only so many sounds. So they're coming from all over the place. And the sound that is now my favorite, which I hated at first, was the I sound is in bike or my. Because it's essentially a southern drawl. Mm-hmm. And I was raised in Kentucky, and I had just spent the last, you know, 7 years of my life kicking that habit. Uh-huh. And I was like, this can't be it. This cannot
this
be how
easy.
You say these words. I sound like I'm from rural Kentucky again. And but then you find the way it's different, and it's just a slight mix of these two sounds that sort of changes it. And I don't know if I necessarily do it well, but it's my favorite one now.
Mm-hmm. And you nailed it now.
And so, you know, it's been a tough thing to learn, but it's fun, and it does add something to your performance. It's exciting hearing the other boys and the different touches from their lives that have come into their accents. Like Rob's character has a little bit of a Liverpool sound from time to time, and Brad, being the goofball, like, I don't know where he's decided he's from, but he's got a little bit of a Cockney thing going on here and there, but not much. And then there's a group of sounds that we all hit the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And it kind of brings us together, I think, for the audience watching the show, that we have these different inflections, but then there are words that we say exactly the same because we spend so much time together. Mm-hmm. That really kind of adds to the camaraderie we already have, that we're all talking like this.
And yeah. Just quickly show me how, give me a little example of what you said and, well, what you had to learn to do. Just take a line or however you actually approach teaching it.
Well, the first rehearsal where I taught was very general. So we went through the breakdown and I said, okay, the I sound, for example, in general American Western, Midwestern speech is I. But for this particular accent, it's I. Mm-hmm. I, and it's very nasal. And I called it the Aflac sound because, like the duck and the Aflac nurses, quack, 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 and you have to get it in your nose. And what's funny is that most actors are very reluctant to sound ugly, especially if they've had training. They've been taught, don't do that nasal sound. And then, of course, poor Will and other Southerners are like, no, that's the sound I've been spending years getting rid of. So I would say, okay, so take the word like or right, which they say a lot, and let's all try it. And you start with a smile, and you say ra, and then you say it. So try that, ra.
Right.
Right.
You have to say it faster.
And then you say it faster. Right, exactly. Yeah. So then I would go around, you know, go through the various sounds, and then go around the group and say, everyone pick a line from the play. So
I remember the first line.
What'd you do?
I used was, I can't take any more enough.
Okay.
And this one was very tricky because it was one of the few circumstances where we use, you say can't instead of can't.
Exactly.
Except with most of the vowel sounds in our dialect, we would use that ca sound. But for can't,
you say
it's
can't.
The only exception, and that's the one I picked. So that's when I decided she was crazy. And so it was, I can't take any more enough.
Exactly. Yes, and that was one of the things, was that each line brings up, oh, by the way, that's an exception to the rule.
Right.
Oh, by the way. But it is important to recognize, again, that this is a dialect that, it, you know, people are inconsistent.
Right.
The trick, however, that is for theater, what I always say is there's reality, and then there's stage reality. And unfortunately, you can't be both, because the audience has to trust you. If people lose the accent halfway through, then they won't believe you anymore. Then you've lost them. They've
right.
left the
pulled
building.
Out of the play, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So consistency is important when it's stage. Mm-hmm. But people in life are not necessarily consistent.
Right.
So with Kant, that's a consistency that had to happen, and that was tricky for them to figure out. Because ask, for example, doesn't rhyme with Kant, which is not true of other British accents.
Right.
So that would be the process. And then we did actually do individual tutorial type sessions in which they came one by one for like 15 minutes or something.
And went through huge chunks of dialogue or...
Or the French.
Important lines.
I was going to say, not only did you have the Yorkshire, you have Yorkshire doing French.
Yes. actually took quite a bit of French throughout my life in junior high and high school, but I only have one short line in that
whole
scene.
That's right,
you're the only one.
It's like a 15-minute scene, and I say one line. But yeah, I mean, it was even tough learning that one line being Yorkshire and French.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think it's really fun for people to think about this because it's an aspect of a show that, if it's done well, really is invisible. You don't think about it. The worst is when you hear an actor and you think, you see how hard they're working at the dialect. Yeah. And it may even be correct, but it has the same effect of pulling you out of the play.
Exactly.
And I thought that in this show, there was just... It was something I didn't worry about at all.
That's great.
The first, you know, few minutes when you're kind of, well, are they going to pull this off? And then I could just let go of it, and I don't remember ever. And it's something that I'm pretty sensitive to. So I just want to congratulate you and the whole cast. But I have to think when it's this big a cast and everyone succeeds, you get a lot of the credit. So,
well, I appreciate that.
So thank you so much for talking about this. All right, and now Don and Nick are going to join us, and Eva's leaving. We're going to talk... much more metaphysically about, I hope, the concept of ensemble. This is a show that brings that word to everybody's lips. It's beautiful ensemble work. And I said that to someone, and then I thought, well, what actually do I mean by that? I know I mean more than that it's a big cast, and there's no kind of one or two main players or parts. But what do I mean, and how do you get it? So I'm going to throw this first to Nick to talk about, you know, if you have anything to say about what you think that quality is, and then even more importantly, maybe how you set about to get it in this show.
Yeah. The quality of a strong ensemble is a sort of magical thing, to be honest with you. And I've had many a strong group of actors that are excellent individually, and even some of whom are excellent as pairs, or even trios, but sometimes that don't feel like an ensemble. What's been exciting about History Boys is that I think one of my early goals at least was to try to make sure that the boys, we created an ensemble amongst the boys, mm-hmm. and kind of an ensemble amongst the teachers, and it that was part of even just where everybody sat in the theater and in the rehearsal room and all that. And I knew that if those two groups could start kind of unifying in a way, the adults and the kids, as it were, that then it would be exciting then to see those two groups coming together on stage and in the world of the play. But what I should say is that the beginning of a great ensemble is way back in auditions and in casting. And I'd love to say to you that I have this magic touch for finding a brilliant ensemble that is going to play well together. I can, you know, suss that out of that audition and say this person is going to be a great ensemble player. A lot of it is just, it's a little bit of instinct and it's a little bit of luck. Mm-hmm. And I mean, surely, especially with the boys, I felt like they had to be an eight-headed monster in this play. Mm-hmm. And many people have said they feel like an octopus, and it's great that people feel that way, because even at the very first audition, it was important to me that I wanted to see them play together. So we did all sorts of kind of trust exercises and actor kind of games and improv things and told stories, and they were all here for an hour and a half or 2 hours each of after they'd done all their individual auditions. They were part of big group auditions. Mm-hmm. And we didn't end up, we had two different groups, and I ended up picking certain people from each group, and it was a very exciting, strange audition. In fact, it's not normal to audition that way. And frankly, if it had been perhaps more seasoned actors, older actors, I might have had a harder time making that happen, mm-hmm. from their standpoint or from the standpoint of even being afraid to do it, because, you know, it's a challenging thing. But when you've got kids that are, I should say, young men that are in their early 20s, and, you know, they were all so damned excited about being in the show, uh-huh. that I could have made them do almost anything, jump off the building, and they probably would have done it. So You know, I mean, that's a little bit true, but but anyway, so that's where it all sort of began, and a lot of it is luck. A lot of it is great chemistry among people that how do you ever really know? And I saw some of it in that room with these people, but I didn't see all of it. We didn't cast them all that day. And most of it ended up coming out of just them being great guys and the adults being great actors, and that this element of actors, professional older actors, and young striving to be professional younger actors coming together in a room, it created this thing that was very much like the play, which is teaching and mentoring and respect and also disobedience and boys getting in trouble and teachers getting mad and, you know, and all those kind of things, but not in a bad way, but in a real way that would naturally happen. So a lot of it just happened naturally on its own, luckily.
Is it true, and John and Will, you can both pitch in here, probably Don Moore, since he has longer history behind him. Is it true that if a cast likes each other, that quality is more likely to happen or not?
Oh, sure.
It is.
Yeah, it's not perhaps even so much liking each other, although that's a huge part of it, but I think it's actually knowing each other. Liking, affection speeds up the intimacy process, I think. So yes, I think liking each other is important, but I think just familiarity. I mean, because that's what it comes down to, is saying, look, you got to be ready for whatever I may throw your way. I promise to make the same accommodation for you, and we're going to toss this ball around and along, and that really is, I mean, it's certainly this kind of play. Most plays can benefit from an ensemble, but particularly this one, because we're all playing the same melody together. We just pass it off, but when we pass it off, it's not like we stop running the race. We're still part of the ensemble. We have to be ready for the ball to come back to us again. I was going to say great stuff that Nick was saying. I don't know who coined the idea of an ensemble for theater work, but I'm sure they must have been familiar with music, and it really is the same way for me. It's like in this, we have the, if the boys are the what, the brass or the winds, and we're the strings,
right.
And, you know, and we have our bits. Sometimes we play the same melody back and forth, or we have just, it really seems a lot of, even though the faculty has their own little ensemble, but every once in a while they play kind of featured performers with the boys, and vice versa, you know.
But let's dig into that analogy a little more,
really,
because that really is something that I thought about before this. When you talk about an ensemble of instrumentalists, you're talking about maybe similar vibratos or the sounds blend. You're talking about perfect attacks where everybody comes in at the same second. You're talking about somehow a quality of tone that matches. Are there specific technical things that you can talk about? The theater is also mysterious, but if we can get it at all concrete, what is it that with a good ensemble works better?
I'd say it really is, it's a perfect analogy, the music, and that I've sung in a lot of choirs, and if you're not listening to each other and you're not hearing each other, you don't get that sound. The vibratos don't match up. The tone can go a little flat, it can go a little sharp, and the thing that's been so, in many ways, miraculous with eight guys around the same age is that really from day one, we all walked in and had decided we were going to listen to each other. Whether it was on stage or off stage, we were going to take that, you know, extra step and be actually interested in what the other person was saying. And it happened with all eight of us, and really with all 12 of us, including the quote-unquote faculty. And that is what makes it so crucial, because if you have that one person who decides that I'm going to do this in this scene to maybe get a little more attention on myself, then it just falls apart. And it's like that one person in the choir who's singing a little bit flat because they were going for the extra belting, you know, there at the end to finish up the song. And that can really hurt. And the boys in the show and the teachers, it seems like, at least at this point, who knows, you know, 70 performances from now. But as of right now, we really are, I mean, I think I can speak for all of us when I say we come to this show every night, looking forward to those moments where all eight of us are on stage mm-hmm. together. Like, I love the scenes I have with Posner and with Dakin, but it's the ones where it's the eight of us, you know, playing with Don, or the eight of us attacking Andrew on stage, and we find each other's parts, and we listen to each other and really play off what the other people are doing, that is what makes it work. And
why don't we, Don, talk a little bit about what it's like for you, as Will just referred to, there's classroom scenes, you're the teacher, there are these eight boys, you've been together a long time, you have a culture in the classroom, but there is a sense from the audience point of view that there are two characters on stage. There's you and there's the boys. Is there anything that changes for you as an actor when you're dealing with this kind of, as Nick said, octopus? I mean, does that change how you work, or is it even really something that you guys perceive on stage? It just happens for us in the audience.
Yes, it is. It's extremely different. I'm not sure I can analyze it. I've been aware of it I've just been teaching for a few years, and it is that same thing. You have, well, and it does, a new analogy works the same for actors. You have an agenda going into the classroom. You have to entertain. You have to keep their attention. And it, in that way, yes, when the eighth leg comes over and wraps around the third leg, you sometimes have to kind of let them know that I need to get through here or whatever. And the space also has challenges that way as well. The audience is also bifurcated, so that we're constantly having to think about the attention that way. So, but it cannot be any harder than a woman raising twins or triplets.
You know, octuplets. You know,
yeah. Well, forget about that.
Our topical reference.
Yes, along that line, I would love it if we could have more students. Not just the eight we have. I'm hoping we can get another six.
Right.
Well, Nick, talk a little bit about the space, because it is an interesting using that alley setup.
It's a very challenging thing that we decided to do. And by we, I mean me and really Brian Bembridge, who's the scenic designer. But let me tell you the reasons why we did what we did, and then I can just discuss some of the challenges a little bit after that. The main thinking was two things. One, from the beginning, this is a play that is so interested in perspective, is so much about really 12 different perspectives on the same story. It's as if it's told from 12 different narrations. Each one of the characters at some point steps out and says, here's my take on how history happens, and here's my take on what's important about this moment or about this part of this story. And you end up kind of realizing throughout the play that they're each telling you, they're all driving you to this moment at the end of the play, the kind of climax of the play. And so that idea of multiple perspectives was very interesting to me from the beginning. And the first idea that I had was, well, wouldn't it be exciting if I could do this in the round? And then literally every audience member has their own perspective. Mm-hmm. You get to see, it's like film. It's like watching one half of a movie or one camera version of a movie. Right. And that's exciting to me. I think that's very helpful. I think it's challenging too, because some people I think come and they say, oh, I wish I could see that, what that other person was thinking.
His back to me was right then.
Right. Yeah. But you know, it's very careful. The staging in this kind of, in this setting has to be so precise. It's like, it's geometry. It's like a pool table with geometry. And it's, you know, my job was to always be aware of, you have to be 2 inches over here, because if you've got somebody's back and can't see the other person's face, both, that's the worst thing that can happen. So right. It's always important that you're able to see somebody's face, and the idea is that you sort of reflect a scene through somebody's eyes. But the point, so that was the main reason for the idea of the alley. The alley then also gives you the sense of in the round, but it also gives you these two prosceniums at the two ends. And from the beginning, we knew that I wanted the boys' rooms involved in all this. So I knew that we wanted to see them, and I didn't think it would be right to have them sitting on stage. I think it would distract too much. So
The idea, I think, was Brian Riley who pushed the idea for the boys in the lobby, and that was great because that became sort of one half of the proscenium, and then the school and sort of the teacher's world became the other half. And
let me interject because I think people who haven't seen it won't quite be able to picture what we're talking about.
Of course.
One of the two prosceniums, which is the lobby of the theater, usually is divided into dorm rooms, sort of like little cells, and you can see four separate spaces. Or more.
Actually, it's eight. Actually, eight. All eight boys'
have
rooms
their own, right.
is the idea. It's interesting that you say dorm rooms because, in fact, they're really supposed to be their home bedrooms because it's not a boarding school.
I wondered about that.
But it's because it's very clear that it's not a boarding school. But but many people look at it that way, and in a way, I think it's fine because it's sort of the same thing. Which is that each of these boys goes to their place, their room, their individual space, and we end up seeing them in that world.
Well, the other thing that happens is that we are introduced to them before the play even starts.
Right.
We have a long, as I think I sat in the theater probably a good 15 minutes, the actors are already in their rooms when you come in, when the audience comes in. So we have a long time to start associating each actor with the particular posters on their wall
right.
or what they're doing.
Right.
And it also creates a wonderful sense of suspense. You know, you just really want the play to get started because you're these people you're already getting to know. Well, let's get back to ensemble. I let us get off onto the setup of the theater. Don, what maybe you could talk about something that Nick did that helps engender a good ensemble.
The first thing that this brings to mind is his recognizing our individual needs or the mini ensembles within the ensembles. Mm-hmm. And we had different ways of rehearsing that were dedicated. We had one night when it was around Hector's scenes. We had another night when it was around each of the faculty members, and then different foci were used to kind of mix up where the attention was going to be paid that particular night. So we all got a sense that we were being supported in our individual needs while still then coming back from those sessions to work as a group.
So those were one-on-one or no? Explain what that was exactly.
For instance, we spent a night working just the scenes that I was in, that Hector is part of.
But with all the actors.
With all the actors, right. Mm-hmm. So it focused not on the overall arc of the play, but just on Hector's arc, so that it gave me an opportunity, given how episodic the play is for everybody involved. I mean, everyone has to constantly be ready to come back. Their spotlight hits them, and it's go time.
Well, that's really interesting, too, because not only would that be useful to you, but it would be useful to the other actors in terms of understanding how the play works from your point of view. If this is frankly about, this is Don's night, then everybody is paying attention to how
yes,
it works.
What do I do to support the other person whose emphasis is being played tonight? Yeah.
Do you have any other answers to that, Will?
Well, in regards to what Nick did to help create this ensemble was, from the start, no matter how big someone's part was compared to any other boys, we were all treated as if it was, one playing field. We were treated as an entity. We all, because, we're early 20s, we're kind of messy. We all had our individual roped-off spaces where we could sit and we could keep our stuff. And sometimes some of Brad's stuff leaked over into my space, but it's okay. I just pushed it back over the line and scolded him a little bit. But it was clear from the start that it was going to be treated like we were all the same amount of importance and with the teachers too. And with that mindset, you just automatically start to group together. And then when it comes to the relationships with the teachers, I mean, we're constantly learning from Don and Terry and Anne and Andrew. And so even now when we're doing these scenes, it's not just our characters paying attention, but as young actors, we're watching this
How
stuff.
How does he
and
do that?
I'm never bored. And right. as soon as those lights come up for the first time in that classroom, it really feels like I'm back in school. And personally, from the play, Don would have been the teacher I love. And so it's a great feeling. And we just immediately start joking around with each other like we really would. And what's interesting is a lot of times you warm up for a show and you do, certain exercises or vocal things. But we've really found that the way we have to prepare for the show is making fun of each other, pulling pranks on each other, hitting each other, doing the stupidest things you could possibly imagine, because we have to get in that mindset, mm-hmm. and we have to be ready to annoy adults, which we're very good at, and we learn throughout the process. But we have to have that kind of stuff in order to bring the energy and that ensemble feeling to the stage.
And it's also vitally important that you continue honing those skills to annoy us.
Right. Well, it was kind of a serendipity here because Nick and Don weren't in the room, but when I was talking to Eve and Will about the dialect, she said something which I thought, and I think maybe Will, one of you said something that was really interesting, which is that dialect work actually reinforced the ensemble quite a bit, and the fact that you were working very hard on how you said particular sounds and how the group of the eight boys began to really coalesce around some of the sounds in the language. I thought that was fascinating and kind of, for me, a double derby that I set up these two very different themes and they somehow came together there. So, well, we're actually out of time and you guys have a show to do, but I want to thank you so much for making the time to talk about this. It's a just terrific production, it really is, and I hope you've already extended. I hope everybody who couldn't get tickets or didn't know they wanted to will now come and buy them, because it's a lovely play and beautiful production. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.